No, I think, yeah. Maybe. That's now recording.
Yep, well, that's it then. So he didn't want to come back to that dream. He was quite happy in retirement. And then found that his $50 million or whatever he had, savings were all taken away. I remember he was quite... I never listened to David.
Yeah, I did recording. Don't bang the table.
Okay, I won't bang the table. Well, most of the pop stars make comebacks because they need the money, basically. Some of them have got so much money they just love making money, but like the Rolling Stones, they're so rich they don't need to keep touring, but other ones need to make comebacks because they just run out of money.
Yes.
The economic imperative. The economic imperative, isn't it? It drives us all at the end of the day. And Bob's gone now. I need Bob because he's the expert. Don't I?
Yes,
maybe he's gone to get me a pint. I thought Jan had gone to get me a pint. I mean, no one's gone to get me a pint.
No.
I'll be pintless.
Oh, sorry. You said, when you came in, you said that you'd have a
beautiful.
I'm going to imperil your...
Right. All right, I'll start talking, and if I dry out, you have to get me a pint. Maybe have half time. Right. It's all the fault... Are you going to introduce me first, don't you?
Oh, yes. This is, of course... she's a member of the BLI, James Alexander.
Oh,
And he's come to give us a talk after about 25, 30 years because he needs the money.
Yeah. That's right.
It's all the fault of the Jews. Come on. Tell the truth
now. No, I was going to say, it's all the fault of the Blackberries.
Ah.
I brought one to show you. If you haven't seen a modern Blackberry, it's a Blackberry. It's all the fault of the Blackberries. That's what's really caused it. It's so raised productivity that the real economy can't cope and it's collapsed.
Ooh.
Because everyone's so productive that. We're producing too many goods now. There's too much intellectual products being produced because of the Blackberries. Because we never leave our offices now because we've got Blackberries all the time. But apart from that, thank you very much for seeing me. And I do talk quite a lot about this at work because I work at a fund manager, M&G. You might have heard of it. Prudential. Think about the Prudential.
Oh,
and I'm still in research. What's called research. And one of my special area, as it has been for quite a while, is looking at the bank and the banks and the banking sector. So I've watched with quite a lot of interest and amusement what's been going on with the banking sector. And I thought I'd like to share some of it with you. But I was interested in Bob's presentation last month about the Austrian theory of the trade cycle, to hear a bit more about the theory and a bit more about how it was last time. Because it's interesting, you've never seen so much debate about the theory of the trade cycle.
Oh, it's
as you have.
It's profound.
And people are sending me notes talking about Hayek's theory of the trade cycle versus other people's theory of the trade cycle. You're also hearing so much about Keynes and how wonderful he was. And it is incredible, but virtually everyone does seem to be a Keynesian. And when the market's really down, everyone says Keynes is right, we need the Keynesian solution because it's special circumstances. And basically, we've got to have the helicopter money thrown at everyone. And then when it's in this sort of situation, Milton Friedman is also called up, who was also, as far as I can see, a Keynesian most of the time. He also thought money should be chucked at the problem as well, and he'd probably be saying the same thing today. But maybe he wouldn't. It's a shame he's passed away. It's a real shame.
I didn't think it was
going
to happen.
The Hobbes is still with
him. Finally did.
He should have held out for a few more years, Milton Friedman, but he didn't, so that's a bit sad. So we don't really know what, no one knows what to do because there's no authority out there at all about the right thing to do. And the only real authority is the head of the Federal Reserve, Mr. Bernanke. And he's an expert on the 1906 crisis, is what he wrote his thesis on, or 1904 one. Not the 1930s one, no. He made his reputation on the 1907 one. So, although, what's his face? Greenspan is still there. And Greenspan is actually part of the problem, as far as I can see, as opposed to being part of the solution. I think one of the root causes of a crisis at the moment is the easy money that Greenspan brought in 1998 and 2002, 2003 to solve the previous bubbles. You're always going to get bubbles. You're always going to get credit booms. And it's how you react to them, I think, is more crucial than and how you try and solve them. That's more crucial than how they're caused, because they will, you know, we will always have booms and busts, because that's just the way people are. They'll get enthusiastic about something and overinvest, and then they'll find out that there isn't actually that much returns in what they're investing in, and there'll be a bust. And it's how you respond to the bust, but also partly how you respond to the boom at the height of the boom. The previous I'm thinking of the owner, the person who controls the price of money, or tries to control the price of money. So the previous incumbent of the Federal Reserve was
Volcker.
Paul Volcker. He has not died.
That's right.
He's still alive, actually, and he didn't say anything at all during the Greenspan years. But he has, since this crisis has erupted, he has said one or two things, actually. And one of the things he did say was that it's the role of the central bank to take away the drink when the party's just getting going.
Remove the punch bowl.
Remove the punch bowl. And sadly, Alan Greenspan did not. He's never removed the punch bowl when the party's got going. And when the party's looking like it's pooping, he's put in a new punch bowl and beered everyone up again. So I think that's overriding thesis is that the Central Bank of America, the Federal Reserve, has completely mismanaged the situation. Now the problem, the money supply over the last, or the price of money over the last 30 years, partly because, I mean, it's almost inevitable it was going to happen because of the structure of the system. When you've got one monopoly supplier of money and one monopoly person to try and attempt to set the price of money, it's inevitable that they're going to get it wrong, because they can't have that much knowledge. And it's an inevitable problem of having a monopoly provider of money. If you have competing monies, you will get booms and busts, but it's less likely to happen. It's just the way the world's gone over the last 100 years is that we have more and more concentrated the supplies of money into one or two or three central banks, and that's a big issue. I also think one of the causes of the current crisis in particular is the gearing up of financial companies, of banks. Now we have a free market more or less in financial companies, in banks and other companies, and we have a marvellously innovative financial sector. But the world wasn't really up to speed with the financial innovation and didn't really spot the core, what would happen with the amount of financial innovation we had. And that most of the financial innovation was designed to increase the gearing, increase the gearing of financial institutions and the credit, basically, in the market. Banks create credit by lending and depositing with each other and lending with each other, and by lending out more in deposits than they take in deposits, and that's how they gear up. But they can also sponsor vehicles that can take even more gearing. They can lend to companies with no deposits and no real assets, and they can lend to them many more times than their assets, or even many more times than the assets they don't have. They can just lend to them whatever they want. And regulatory requirements. There are lots of regulatory requirements. We had you might have heard about Basel I or the Basel rules. Those were introduced in 1989.
We're on Basel II, aren't we?
We're on Basel II now, but back in 1988, banks. We've had numerous banking crises since the Second World War. We've also had banking crises. Banks are dangerous animals and need regulating. The trouble is, the more you regulate them, the more they find ways to get around the regulation, and the result is misery, because they're so clever at getting around the regulations. It feels fantastic when they're getting around the regulations, because they are then pumping more credit into the economy. Not money, but credit.
Would you say the same with free banks would be as wild, do you think?
Free banks?
Well, with a free banking system, no state bank.
I'd have to go, well, I'm not there yet. I haven't got to some solutions. So I was just going to I thought you'd like to hear about the crisis, though.
Yeah, yeah. Good.
And exactly where we got. So we could talk about that. But it is interesting because you have so much laissez-faire in financial services because banks work hard to get around the regulations that the regulators set them. So the Basel I came in 1998 because in the 1980s the Japanese banks had appeared on the scene as a result of the Japanese miracle, economic miracle, and they started lending way more than they took in deposits with each other, and they started lending to everyone, also everyone around the world, and created a massive credit bubble themselves. And as a way to try and get control of that Japanese credit bubble before it destroyed the world in terms of asset prices, they brought in some regulations to control these blooming Japanese banks, and they said you couldn't have more than a certain amount of assets relative to your equity. Now they allowed the banks, Japanese banks, to count all sorts of non-cash as equity, all sorts of funny things like unrealized gains on their equity portfolios, which were busy pumping up the prices of their equity, so they had lots of gains on their equities and they were able to count those as capital, or some of them. And they were allowed to count all sorts of debt instruments as equity as well. But basically they did try and control it. It was an admirable effort by a bloke called Peter Cook, who was the head of auditing at PwC. He wrote on the back of an envelope, particularly, the Basel I rules. And it did actually rein in the Japanese banks. It did help prick the Japanese bubble before it got... I mean, it was pretty disastrous. They've had, 15, 20 years of virtually no growth, so...
But the quality of things improved.
Maybe. But they did have... I think their Japanese wasn't the value of the property in Tokyo at the height of the Japanese property bubble was worth more than all the property in America.
I heard it was the Palace grounds were worth more than California.
Maybe, that sort of thing. So if you had the Palace grounds for the rest of Tokyo, it probably was worth more than the whole of America, because California's quite big. That was how bad the asset bubble had got because of the credit creation by the banks in Japan. But they were pulled back because they were why the Western world got very upset about the Japanese banks is because they were causing an asset bubble. It was leaking out of Japan and going into the Western world. So they had to try and get some control of them. So the regulators brought in Basel I, the Cook ratios they were called. And that did, for a time, get control of the banks, of the Japanese banks and the system. I think we did have a credit crunch in 89. There's some other things going on in 89 to 92, some of you probably remember, the split in the LA, that sort of thing. But there's some other things too. There was a small crisis in the UK with 15% interest rates, and then went to 12, and we fell out of the ERM and all that sort of thing. But there was there were some minor issues in the UK, but there was minor relative to the rest of the world. But the rest of the world did have a bit of a crunch between 89 and 92, as the Japanese credit bubble was deflated and banks generally had to deflate. And then between 1993 and 1998, we had a nice old rally again. Everything got better because the world was basically recovering. Assets were being reallocated to their best uses, and returns were falling to more normal levels. Unfortunately, it was such a good idea just getting around the regulations that some other banks could work out a way to do it. And we had the Asian crisis in 1997, 1998, the Russian crisis, because they were desperate. What happens is there is an element that I don't know whether I've got something here, but there is an element that everyone is guilty with this crisis, is what the bankers like to say when you put them into a corner. They say it's everyone's fault, because people want to get returns on their savings. They want to get yield. There's a real hunt for yield. In a normal deflationary environment that we had through large periods of the 19th century and some of the 20th century, deflation is normal, falling prices.
So
interest rates would be very low. There is a time value of money, but it's going to be 1% or something like that.
Your savings would buy more by being in your drawer.
Yes, but not everyone always understands that, and there's lots of greedy people out there who want to get more than the interest rate. Want to get 1%, 2%, a bit more than the market rate all the time. And there's lots of people out there who are quite happy to take money from fools. And they will find ways to get you more than the natural yield, natural interest rate. 100 basis points, 200 basis points, 1% to 2% more than an actual yield. And so they will find people, they'll take you in savings, and they'll find someone who's, they'll give you 5% interest rate or 10% interest rate. And then in the mid-1990s, that was the emerging markets. That was the Russians and the sort of decommunizing Asian countries.
Isn't that what
not talking about my fund. I'll come to that later. I'm just trying to describe a bit of economic history first. I only invested it. I'm an equity. We invest in equities. So it's a bit different. Certainly equities are a difficult area, but the as you probably noticed.
Mm.
But the point is, what's going on is there's always a search for yields to get a bit more than the natural market interest rate. And while that goes on, people are very impatient. People are very greedy because they want, and it's the same. You know, I'm sure we could spot in 17th, 18th, 19th, and going back to all sorts of centuries. People always want a bit more return on their savings. They're not really satisfied with just seeing things get cheaper. Well, yeah, because they've saved up their £1 million or their £100,000 or their £10,000, and they want to get 5%. They want to live off those, their interest. And yeah, we've all seen the 19th century novel Dickens, where people put their money in the funds and they get 1%. You know, it's a life of penury when you put your money in the funds, but basically that's it. If you want to do better than that, you've got to know what you're doing. And most people think they can get more than that 1% by trusting other people, banks, financial advisors, to get more than that 1%. And these financial advisors and banks and investment banks are very happy, very, very happy to find places for you to get more than your 1%. Why are they so happy to do that? Because they know that their firm will get bailed out by the government if things go wrong, and your savings will be protected. So in a way, you're happy to give those banks your money because you know there's a kind of implicit contract with the government all the time that if something goes wrong, your savings will be safe. Not just the £30,000, the first deposit guarantee scheme, you know. And what the investment bankers know is if they really do it really a lot, in a really, really big way, where they become so embedded in the financial system, they know that they'll be so big, they'll be too big to fail. And the too big to fail is the key issue, is that they know they'll be too big to fail, the investors, the depositors know they're too big to fail, and therefore they are too big to fail.
That's right.
There is some issues with some banks, yeah, where the countries are too small to bail them out, where the banks get so big that they are too big to fail, but the guarantor is too small to save them.
I don't think it works for
people. I have been hoping.
You'd think.
Managers also are protected by the bank, so they don't lose what their customers lose.
Yeah, they never have to give back. Well, some are giving back bonuses, actually. There is just a bit of a bonus give back by some of the very senior managers in some places or in some sorts of ways. But hopefully not too much. It looks like a free market. It looks like laissez-faire. And it looks like there are some agencies that you'd expect to grow up, ratings agencies that you'd expect to be there to help out, to try and help us, guide us to the reputable institutions that aren't.
It's all AAA as far as I can see.
Yeah, the ratings agencies are there, but there's some problems with the ratings agencies, and there's problems with the way it works. And I think the biggest problem with the ratings agencies is that they become institutionalised by the governments. So that the governments then set rules that people are only allowed to invest if things are AAA, or AA, or single A, or BBB or investment grade. And so the ratings agencies effectively become part of the government and become so relied on, they don't quite understand what, or the people there get different economic incentives about what their role is. They're not, actually it is incredible but true, but ratings agencies, you wouldn't, if I asked you as a man in the street, who pays the ratings agencies? Is it the investor or is it the product manufacturer? Yes, it's a product manufacturer. Can you imagine a more stupid world? where the rater, you know, where the person is, which, like which consumer magazine getting paid by the producer of the product. It's just utter madness, but that's what happens. The ratings agencies get paid by the issuer of the debt or the bond or the instrument rather than by the buyer of the instrument. And then why does that happen? Because, well, I'm not 100% sure why that happened. I'm not sure why that happened, but that's the way it grew up. It's because they're not so bad as ratings agencies. Ratings agencies are far worse. I think what happens is because a bank or an investment bank goes out and says we want to produce this product and we want to sell it to people, but the people don't know it, they want it. So you're an independent ratings agency. Can you, in your independent way, please rate this product for us? And you've got a reputation and you're regulated by various regulatory agencies around the world, government agencies, that please can you rate it for us? And the investors, who are stupid and greedy, rely on these ratings, because they don't have to rely on the ratings. They can set up their internal research teams and do the ratings themselves, or they could try and pay someone to do the rating.
Or pick 30 companies from the top 300 at random. It's not bad.
They could do that, but some of the bigger investors do have their own research teams. You know, reputable companies like Prudential does have its own credit rating team, and they do put ratings on things and do disagree an awful lot of the time with the ratings agencies. But Prudential is a bit of an old fashioned firm, and it gets a lot of things wrong as well. I can go into that later. But there's lots of other people who aren't quite as scrupulous as Prudential and are quite happy just to take the ratings agency's word for it. Many of them are central banks, pension funds, private banks in Switzerland, who just get the money in because it's Switzerland. That's, they've got the reputation of Switzerland, so they take the money because it's Switzerland, and that's enough really. Prudential has to actually work for its reputation quite often, but Switzerland doesn't really. It's just because it's secret, it's got a reputation, and private, and the guys there just look at the ratings agency's ratings, and that's all they do, and so pile the money in. There's also a thing that happens is that if it's very short-term money, like if it's highly liquid money, you don't really need to worry too much about the rating, because you can get your money out very quickly. And so there's a whole world grew up over the last few years to fool people into thinking that because the ratings are high, and we know ratings agencies, they're a joke, but you know, the ratings are high, that because the money's liquid, it doesn't really matter about the rating, and it doesn't really matter about much actually, because it's all so short term. It's overnight, it's commercial paper that's no more than 90 days and it rolls over and get the money back. Because there's so many people got gulled into believing that was all right, more and more money piled into these short term instruments, commercial paper, and the investment bank saw that. And there's a demand for yield, so people want to get a bit more than the market interest rate. And so what you got was commercial paper programs, which is 90-day commercial paper programs, being set up by unregulated, vaguely bank-guaranteed vehicles called sieves and conduits and whatnot, that would invest in long-term paper but fund themselves short-term. It's a very old trick. The banks do actually fund themselves short and lend long, take deposits that they on-demand deposits and lend mortgages. That's what banks do. But they, you know, everyone knows they're doing that and doesn't want them to go too long term. Wants them to have a big liquidity buffer and wants them to be very sure of the money they're lending is very safe with the people they're lending it to. When you get to what they call asset-backed commercial paper programs, you've got many layers in this. It's called risk layering in the trade. So you get some person who's lending money to what looks like a AAA 90-day bank guaranteed vehicle. So you can't go wrong with that. When they say bank guarantee, they mean liquidity is guaranteed, not guaranteeing a credit. You are taking a credit risk, but it's guaranteed liquidity. So it's guaranteed something, but actually liquidity rather than credit. Liquidity means you can get your money out. If there's some issues...
At any time.
If there's some issues with the... If there's some temporary timing differences between the collection of the debt or the repayment of the debt and the need for you to get your cash out, the bank will step in and smooth the process. But it's only smoothing the process, it's not taking the credit risk, and I think that was sometimes, or very often, lost in the process. So you put your money into a money market mutual fund. The money market mutual fund will buy a 90-day commercial paper, piece of commercial paper, from an asset-backed commercial paper vehicle with a bank liquidity guarantee. Fantastic. That's all right, isn't it? And then it's a AAA bank, and it's a AAA vehicle, and the assets they're buying are AAA. You've got no worries, really, have you? But there's a bit of the layering comes in, because the fact that it's just a liquidity guarantee and not a real guarantee means a bit of people can take a bit of margin out of that and a bit more leeway, maybe, to invest in things that they wouldn't have otherwise invested in. And the asset backed paper. In the vehicle, those assets, because they're all AAA rated, it's all right, isn't it? And the person doing the buying is actually often one or two blokes or ladies in some funny vehicle that doesn't really have any research. It's just relying on the credit ratings and taking the money, and the bank guarantees liquidity, so that's all right. But they're just buying stuff that the investment banks and the banks are selling to them, asset-backed paper. And they're buying, so they're a company funding themselves on commercial paper, buying with short-term commercial paper, buying long-term assets or five-year assets. When the system started going, a lot of these assets were quite short-term. They were motor loan receivables and office supply equipment, office equipment receivables, and that sort of thing. But that worked quite well. But hey, you know, you could put in a few other things in there as well. You could put some slightly longer term assets like mortgages in there. If they were correctly structured and all AAA, obviously. And so more and more savings was piling into these money market mutual funds that were promising 10 or 50, 0.5% more than money market rates, or a bit more than money, 10 basis points often, 0.1% more than money market, or money market, even money market rates, because only banks are really meant to get money market rates, because that's the interbank market where they give themselves, and if you're a depositor in the bank, you're getting money market rates minus 1 or 2% usually, but hey, I want to get what the bank's getting, and a bit more. So I want to get the banks professionally lending to each other, pay each other, you know, borrow at quite high rates, but if you're only a humble depositor with your cheque account or your savings account, your Halifax Gold Plus, you're getting 1% and the banks are getting 5%. So you want to put it into something a bit more racy, so you're going to get what the banks are getting with each other. But the banks, when they're getting that money, they're actually lending the money themselves and making sure the credit risk is very safe, generally, not always. So in America in particular, where money market funds were big, but it's the same sort of thing that happened in various ways everywhere else in the world. So they put these credit card receivables in, or motor loan receivables, or office equipment receivables. Then they started putting some prime mortgages in. But as more money started pouring into these money market mutual funds, where people get what the banks are getting, money market rates, the yield, what the lenders could lend at to the customers went down, because there was more money going in. So the mortgage borrower got better and better rates all the time, until he was pretty much all borrowed out, the best mortgage borrowers. And so then you got, well, we better find some other people who can pay some rates, some slightly more risky people. And that's good, but hang on, these more risky people, we know they're more risky people, so we've got to be a bit more careful here. So we've got to create some securities, some parceling up of these subprime. The first one was Alt A, which is like not quite prime, because they were larger loans or something like that. So got to find some other way of parceling up these into some other assets, whereby maybe some people, someone out there took the worst risk and the best risks of the loan went into the commercial paper program, or the asset-backed commercial paper program. And so banks would, the first 10% loss, for the sake of argument, would be held by the bank, and the other 90% would be put into a securitized paper program, securitization, that would then be bought by the by this vehicle that would then fund short commercial paper, short term commercial paper. But it was such a good game, and no one, there's no, because you know, house prices are rising, don't forget, with all this money going in. Yeah, house prices are rising, so actually, you know, the risk of any defaults and actually losing that 10% were going down, so you could start putting a bit more riskier stuff. Well, obviously it's not risky, but in the old days it would have been seen as more risky, so we could start putting more riskier stuff in.
They're very silly in the old days.
But it was going, this was going round and round, this merry-go-round. It got so great that what they could do, you know, so we had only the first 95%, the equity bit, what they call the equity bit of the mortgage, the 5% first loss portion if your mortgage does go wrong, because you're only ever going to lose 5% if the mortgage goes wrong, or 2%. It got so bad that they could actually pass the lat up into a special purpose vehicle, and because you had 100 different bits of that, 100 different loans in that, which wouldn't all default at the same time, they might default some of them, you could actually create AAA securities out of the equity part of all the loans. And it got really wonderful. So you had a subprime, which you've all heard about, subprime mortgage securitization business, where someone with no assets, no job, and also partly, you know, factored in, but partly encouraged by the US government in its very generous mortgage interest relief program. So I think you could get some people basically on the dole in America who would could basically take out a $1 million mortgage because they were a person, and all you needed was a person. You can lend the money. They didn't have to make any loans because there's special, some of these mortgages got so interesting that they didn't actually have to pay any interest for the first 2 years, or just a token interest, barely covered by their social security check.
But that's because the house would appreciate in price. And
yeah.
Assets.
Yep, yeah, that's right. And so you have some people on social security getting rather large mortgages, and the mortgages would get put into this sausage machine, where it goes through and transfer through several hands, so the person taking the risk was a Japanese housewife or a Swiss private banking client who just bought the stuff because he was buying it from a reputable financial intermediary who got it from a bank who got it AAA rated. I mean, it sounds incredible, and it's true, that this actually happened. And so you could get $500 billion or $1 trillion of subprime mortgages with people who should never have had mortgages.
Where's the downside? The house price is going up.
Yeah.
If you foreclose, you've got to...
But it's a wonderful free market working here, of financial innovation.
Freedom within state regulation.
The financial innovation is very, very clever. It got even worse, you know, because there was such demand, there were such greedy investors for the yield on these things, because everyone wanted to get what the bank's getting plus a bit more. It's incredible but true. They create synthetic versions of these subprime mortgages. They'd create indexes so people could hedge the risk.
What does that mean? You're betting on the outcome or something?
They create indexes based on... They create indexes of how these mortgages were performing, and then you could make a bet on the index. It's a bit like spread betting, really. It's not very different. And some banks would... You'd want new people to keep coming into the market to drive down the risk, to keep the spreads low on the mortgages. And the more people you got into the highest risk parts of this, the more safer bits you could create. So the more people willing to take the highest risk, the more clever ways you could package up the highest risk, the more safer risk you could create that would then finance these subprime mortgages. So you really had to have some people really, really keen to take this highest risk stuff. Otherwise you couldn't create the securitizations that would mean you could lend to the subprime mortgages. But there was, the world got so mad, there was such demand for this, you had to create synthetic, they created synthetic instruments that would bet on the equity part. Because you could make it AAA, because there's never going to be any defaults because house prices are going up. And even if the house prices, even if you had some defaults, they wouldn't be correlated, so it would happen over a long period of time and it wouldn't really matter.
Exactly.
Could you not have had, first of all? And so UBS, Union Bank of Switzerland, were so dead keen on this stuff, and they were so brainless. They'd signed some contracts to get, you know, a few million dollars a year, from some of this stuff. They would actually sign them up to $20-30 billion of risk.
Absolutely.
When it went against them. So it's a bit like spread betting without stop losses, except worse, because, you know,
anyone assumed that, all right, you lose what you lend them. Oh no, no.
It's so old fashioned, Bob. Not even that. You'd lose against the index, not just what you lend them.
The mortgage lenders, maybe the same way, but they're not the insurances,
there was lots of insurance is called hedging in the world we work in, because if you call it insurance, it gets regulated by the New York State Insurance. New York State Insurance Office.
Why could not?
And you don't want that, because they're quite tough.
Is that the way you work?
Yes.
We have questions afterwards, yes.
Yeah.
All questions.
I forgot the questions.
Write it down.
Take a note.
I'll give you a pencil. It looks like a wonderful... Alan Greenspan thought this was wonderful, and he made speeches about how financial innovation was a good thing and leading to greater spreading of risk and greater sophistication in risk management. The head of Barclays Capital about 2 years ago, Barclays Bank's investment bank, called it the golden age of risk management we're in. And it did seem like that. Obviously, it seemed like that. Otherwise, people wouldn't have carried on doing what they were doing. And it's a lot of really clever people, and there's a lot of market mechanisms out there. So it looked like laissez-faire. It didn't really look like laissez-faire. But what it was a massive Ponzi scheme, a massive bubble that was so sophisticated that 95% of the people in it, producing the stuff, thought they were doing the right thing. There weren't many crooks, actually, who understood it and could criticise it. There were very, very few crooks. It's bizarre, but there were very, very few crooks in it, actually.
You could tell they weren't crooks. They lost money.
Most of them have lost money. An awful lot of them have lost money.
Did you make money?
So it's a... Did I make money? I wish I had. I wouldn't be here now. I'd be in the Bahamas, wouldn't I? Obviously, that's what normal response is. There was no mastermind. It was an invisible hand working here to create this scheme. And I think there's even worse bits about it. I mean, there's so many bizarre things that happened. One was the investment banks, the U.S. investment banks, for instance. Greenspan and others supported the deregulation of the US investment banks. I probably supported the deregulation. Deregulation is a good thing, isn't it? The Glass-Steagall Act of 1931 or whatever it was, 1932, that separated banks from investment banks was a bad thing, because, you know, why shouldn't investment banks be allowed to make loans and I think it's underwrite securities rather than just arranging the underwriting of securities issues. Why shouldn't they be able to do it? Nonsense, isn't it? It's not very sensible. And so investment banks were sadly half deregulated in 1999. They were half deregulated. They were allowed to underwrite securities and make loans, but they weren't allowed to collect deposits, because that was still a bit, shouldn't be allowed to. So you actually create animals that are not part of the ordinary banking regulation landscape. They're investment banks. They're still regulated by the investment banking regulator, the SEC, And their balance sheets of these investment banks on deregulation were about 20% of US GDP as a measure that you can use. By 2007, about 10 years later, they were 100% of US GDP and they had no deposits. So that's not a great thing to happen. That's rather a lot of credit creation that they're involved in.
They sold a lot of bonds
and other things. It's not just
they
bonds. You might have heard, I know none of you probably heard of repo markets. So there's repurchase markets. And it's a way whereby you take an asset and you lend it to someone and they sell it and they give you the cash as a collateral for borrowing the asset. And that can happen no one really knows how many times that asset gets lent on, borrowed and sold, and cash goes as collateral. But what happens each time is why people like to do that is because often the investment bank doesn't have any assets, but if it borrows it and sells it and gives the cash, it has a bit of a balance sheet then. It's got the asset then and sold it and gives the cash back to the person it's borrowed from. And then it's paying it loses about 1% on the transaction, say, for the sake of argument. But it can see an opportunity where it's going to make 5%. So what it does, it uses the cash. So it sells the asset. So what it does, it's got a balance sheet. It borrows another asset from someone else, because it's got a bit of a balance sheet. And so it sells it, takes the cash and gives the cash as collateral. But the asset it borrows a second time is slightly more risky because it thinks it's going to go off of it. And it happens several times. And investment banks build rather large balance sheets by borrowing assets from the likes of Prudential, actually. And getting a merry-go-round of funding and financing from doing that. Each time taking a bit more risk and leveraging themselves up, basically. They had a bit of capital, so we thought they were safe when they did it. But they soon have balance sheets that are 100% of US GDP. And there's a little thing here. You can't see this very well, certainly if you're at the back. But what it shows was that in 1925, total debt of the US was about 150% of US GDP. By 1930, it had gone to about 250% as credit had multiplied because of the banks doing what they do. It fell back to 170% in 1935 and fell back to about 150% and stayed at about 150% until 1980, at which point we began our long march up again. So this is the credit market bubble in the late 1920s up to 180%, and then we had the long march up to 2007, when it reached 350% of US GDP credit as a percentage of GDP. That's quite a weight to bear, and it was basically driven by banks, investment banks and banks.
Well, what is it in the UK?
The UK is the same sort of numbers, sadly. Now why does that happen? It's because banks work very hard to get around the regulations. Funnily enough, the regulators set regulations, and we get regulatory arbitrage. It's called regulatory arbitrage. Now, if Prudential sold something to a private customer against the spirit of the rules, we would get slammed by the FSA, and they wouldn't like that. Or a small IFA did something, you would get slammed. Yeah, we know you're not allowed to open your Swiss private banking account, but we can do it around this way. They would get slammed, being in the spirit of the rules. But banks can do that because they can do it. And the regulators knew they were doing it and connived at it, but decided because we can stop it, we'll just try and sort of control it a bit and regulate it a bit. And so you get these banks doing stuff that the central banks don't, well, not the central banks, the regulators, because they're not always the same thing, don't want them to do, but no, they can't stop it because they're international and they can create vehicles. And obviously with regulators all the time, everywhere, they get captured by the people they regulate. It's a basic human law. And the career path of the average regulator is, I'll spend 5 years at a regulator and then go get a good job at the bank I'm regulating, or the electricity company, or the telephone company. And so you get regulated capitalism. And when you get regulated bank capitalism, it's much more toxic than telecom regulated capitalism or utilities regulated capitalism or whatever. And so banks get away with it in an enormous, huge way. And so they put things off balance sheet, basically, is what they do. So some of their ratios look all right, and actually they've moved a load of stuff off balance sheet. Or they just count things differently. Basel II was a much more sophisticated, the J.P. Morgan in particular worked very hard, because the back of the envelope thing that Peter Cook of PwC did was obviously incredibly naive and stupid and just, you know, almost like the Stone Age. And so you have to be much more sophisticated than that. And we have to, rather than just saying mortgages are 50% risk-weighted and corporate loans are 100% risk-weighted, we're going to rate things according to their ratings by the ratings agencies, or if you're super sophisticated, you rate it according to your own internal ratings by your clever team, because you know more than everyone knows these ratings agencies are stupid and not, you know. But so you can either do it according to the ratings agencies, and the regulator will sign off the models used by the internal ratings people inside the bank if they're smart enough. And so you get madness piled on madness. You also get insurance companies getting in on the act, because one thing they can do is, it's partly a part of regulatory arbitrage, because they're not banks, doesn't matter how geared they are.
AIG,
yeah. It can write some, in its financial products division, not in its main motor insurance division, but in this sort of, because it's making so much money in its motor insurance division, its life insurance division, it can be a bit more ratey in some other areas, because it's got all uncorrelated risk. It's a bit more exciting things in its other area. And you can insure some of these securitizations that I was talking about earlier to make them even safer, and you can make them super senior AAA if you get an insurance company to insure them. Because if they're insuring enough, it's just like any insurance, if you're insuring enough, then it...
If everyone has an accident at the same time.
Yes, but this is insurance,
isn't
it?
That's
very good point. But you can also create, not only can AIG do this, you can create some really specialist vehicles. AIG maybe is a bit dodgy, and okay, it only insured 500 billion of these things, but you can get some specialist vehicles called MBIA or AMBAC, monoline insurance, that grew out of insuring things that didn't need insuring, which were US municipal debt. But you get a little bit cheaper if you have it insured. But you can insure these securitization vehicles and all sorts of financial market risk if you're really smart. And these monoline insurance companies grew up, and on very little capital, because insurance companies don't have a lot of capital, it's not really normal insurance business. And I don't know how many of you have read, because you can get onto this, Fooled by Randomness. There's quite a lot in there about tail events and correlation risks, because it's all about correlation. As long as people don't have a fire at the same time, it's all right to do sell a fire insurance. You could go bust if you have the Great Fire of London, but perhaps you'll insure London, New York, Hong Kong, San Francisco. It'll be all right for you. And the same way, financial products can be insured. As long as there's no correlation between the things you're insuring, it's correlation is what you're playing. I mean, it gets rather statistical on this, sadly. But you're insuring, what insurance companies are really doing is correlation risk. And so you can go back in history and look at all these mortgages that have never all defaulted at the same time, or if they have, it's no more than 2% in a year. And that's not that bad, 2% in a year. You can insure against that. And as long as you're in lots of cities or in lots of countries or in lots of different types of mortgages, even better, then you're going to be all right. And so these specialist insurance companies who are experts in correlation got into this business. So they help enhance the credit quality of the securitizations that the money market mutual funds buy. Well, sorry, the vehicles that are buying the securitizations that the money market mutual funds are buying the commercial paper of. It's all, you know, we're all quite far away from these things. It's called credit enhancement, actually. It's not, that's what it's called. Yeah, the upshot of all this I've got here is that the credit became very, very easy, and worse, it became cheap. Partly so, it was only at a few basis points above the money market, above what banks lent to each other, and thanks to a couple of blow-ups in 1998 and 2002, the Asian crisis and the tech crisis, Greenspan had helpfully lowered interest rates down to 1% for 2 or 3, 4 years after 2002, and that was just marvellous. So not only were real interest rates low, you didn't have to pay much above them for your mortgage. So, you know, basically, and if you had an interest rate holiday as well for a couple of years, it's just fantastic, isn't it, really? And
for
if you're just renting, you know, paying whatever rent, you can borrow for half the rent and own a house and make a capital gain when the house goes up in price. It's just fantastic, isn't it? So what we got was 20-30% house price appreciation for several years in lots of countries in the world. until it has to stop, of course, at some point, because it's a Ponzi scheme.
And we have a permanent boom.
There's lots of theories. You know, lots of banks like to point out why the bubble burst, why it went wrong, is because they point to one thing or other that is someone, some evil person. You know, pricked it. Some claim it was in summer of 2006 when BNP couldn't value some of the securities in one of its money market funds. Some of its super yielding money market funds.
That bank now,
and that caused the problem. But some people had been seeing some issues before then. I don't know, 2007.
So this one was lending money that.
HSBC, our Midland Bank. HSBC? Dear old Midland Bank.
Oh, yeah.
They bought a consumer finance company in America called Household that was doing unsecured loans, not mortgages very much, but unsecured loans, in 2003 at the bottom of the previous crisis. They thought they got a fantastic deal. And one of the... They then left it alone because they thought the blokes knew what they were doing, despite the fact they bought the company, it was almost bust. But they thought these people really knew what they were doing. And what they could do was they could sell mortgages to some of these people, because they had a Household with a merger of two older companies, Household and an unsecured mortgage. They had all these rough customers and had these sort of nice mortgage products to better customers who could afford to pay them. And they thought, well, why don't we sell some of these several mortgages to some of these rough customers? Because interest rates are low and we can get... You know, and so they built up a huge book of mortgages, $100 billion of mortgages, pretty damn quick, to subprime customers. They thought, when I questioned them about this, they thought it was all right because a really good bank called Wells Fargo on the West Coast was also doing it, apparently. And they were second only to Wells Fargo in these loans. What they didn't know was Wells Fargo were just looking after the loans. They had no credit risk on the loans, but they wanted to appear like they were doing something, so they fixed the lead tables to make them appear that they had $100 million of these loans. But actually, they didn't have any on their books. They were just looking after them for other people. And so HSBC got these loans, and then they found that they were defaulting before any payments. Well, hang on, they were defaulting on the first payment. So they lent $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 to someone, and they wouldn't get the first payment. What? Which is pretty dangerous, really. Hang on.
How much of the money that was lent had actually been saved? And how much of it was simply central bank creation out of thin air?
Not central bank. Bank, yeah. It was
right, bank, yeah.
How much of the money had been saved that was lent? Well, a lot of HSBC's money was... saved because it was Hong Kong savers. But a lot of the Wells Fargo mortgages that they'd done, they were looking after someone out for someone else, that was securitized basically into these securitization markets.
Because all this stuff could be wrapped up through into these very, very safe securities, they didn't need to have money.
Oh, there's a
dead end. Yeah.
So there would be someone funding it. There would be someone that's commercial.
Question,
Yes, sir. I've got all this finished. I've got all this finished.
Finish,
8:10, I've got to finish, haven't I? Yeah. So,
very good.
The money was, it's a good question, where did the money was saved? I think the money was saved, but it was also money that had been almost created out of nothing by people taking gains, by selling their house and putting the money into, you know, by downsizing, or playing the equity market, or getting bonuses from investment banks for structuring this stuff. It was real money that had been paid out and then saved in money market mutual funds, or various other vehicles, hedge funds, various things, just put into. So it was real money in some senses, but it was money that had been ill-gotten gains, might be another word to talk about it. But a lot of other people did have genuinely gotten gains, but there's a lot of ill-gotten gains out there as well. So the bubbles burst, little triggers all over the place, but Lehman Brothers bankruptcy was a bubble. All the bankers I've spoken to said Lehman, but always used to tell me Lehman Brothers was too big to fail. I disagreed with them, but they were so into it because it was so intimate, it was so connected to the market, they couldn't conceive of it failing, but it did fail. A bit of an accident. It was too big to sort of save and too big to fail all at the same time. We did have other. Obviously, we had Balloon. We had our own Lehman Brothers before then. We had Northern Rock, which was too big to fail. That was rescued. We had various German banks. We had Bear Stearns. That was too big to fail. Before Lehman Brothers, that was a smaller investment bank. It was rescued by J.P. Morgan with the help of the Federal Reserve subsidies. Lehman's was too big to fail, but it did fail. AIG is too big to fail, but it's sort of been rescued. HBOS has failed, but it's too big to fail, and that's been rescued by the government and by Lloyd's. Various insurance companies, loads of US sort of specialist financial firms, all the big car companies, all the big engineering companies, they're all failing, too big to fail. Spanish savings banks, Nordic banks, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, they're all too big to fail, but they're also all slightly too big to rescue as well. And so we're actually, what the market's actually very good at, one thing the market is good at, is sniffing out the weakest players, the most egregious business models. They go first. So Northern Rock was, with its 200% loan to deposit ratio and massive amount of lending long, borrowing short, went early. Lehman Brothers was the most active player in the mortgage market and very weak, and that went early. So the weak AIG, with its guarantees, that's gone early. I did say it in one of my presentations at work, it's like a tide going out, and the stuff. And then someone said, that's wrong, because the tide's going out, it's not going to come back in again. So it's not really like, it's a bubble bursting. The bubble's not going to get pumped up again. And people fall off as the bubble shrinks. It's not really like a bubble bursting, it's a bubble deflating. And people just fall off. And the weaker ones fall off first.
As the tide's going out.
A lot of metaphors there, but it's not a tide going out. It's a bubble, it's a balloon shrinking. The central banks are pumping lots of money, and we are having this is the biggest bubble ever in terms of money, 350% of US GDP, and probably more than that, because there's a lot of it that's not counted, because it was in vehicles that weren't really counted ever. Hedge funds, for instance, they were all geared up as well. So there was a very big trend to put money into hedge funds. They got 30-40% growth in money being invested into hedge funds, our money actually, by pension funds and all sorts of people and private banks, pretty much. And then they were geared up, these hedge funds, so they were a bit like citizen conduits. They were geared up on little capital, 5-6 times, 10 times, 20 times. We had LTC, what's bizarre is we had LTCM back in 1998, and you thought, well, that was terrible, wasn't it? It was 100 times geared, never again LTCM, that hedge fund, 1998. And actually, most of the world think, what a fantastic idea, if we do it right. And so, and in 2002 we had Enron with its off-balance sheet vehicles. Maybe, I don't know how many of you have watched the smartest guys in the room, Enron, the smartest guys. It's a fantastic film made by, I think it's a documentary.
Michael Moore.
I don't know if it's by Michael Moore,
but
it is a very good film. You can all watch Enron. But again, off-balance sheet vehicles with limited capital, I thought, by 2006, I thought they'd gone. I'm stupid and naive. But I was on holiday in July 2006. I was rung up by one of my junior, one of my team, He said, James, have you heard about asset-backed commercial paper vehicles? I said, no. And he told me, I got sent some emails, and he told me, I couldn't believe it. I was spent the whole day of my holiday thinking, I thought with Enron, they'd been outlawed, and they were illegal, these off-balance sheet vehicles with limited capital. But actually, the banks thought, what a fantastic idea. We're going to have loads more of them. And so they proliferated around the system. And so that's why we've got possibly more than 350% debt to GDP in America. Maybe it's like 450, or it's a really big number. And that means it's a lot to deflate. And as in all these processes, as you well know, in the 1930s, when it deflates, it's painful because resources have to be allocated to their correct uses, and not the ones they're working on at the moment. And that's quite a big reallocation of resources, actually.
It's a slow puncture, really.
It's a slow puncture if the central banks put enough taxpayers. Well, first of all, they put taxpayers' money into slowing the puncture down. But is that a good use of taxpayers' money? We get into the question. Is it best to have a short, sharp shock or a 10-year, long, drawn-out thing that may be sort of bailed out by the Second World War, sort of thing? Mm-hmm. That, you know, people forget about it, and actually, we've had 400% inflation in the meantime. The inflation during the war was to do with the war, or was it really actually just the catching up of the deflating bubble that was then subsidised by the governments? You know, I think it raises quite a lot of questions about that. So my question is, my thing was causes and solutions. I haven't got any solutions. It is a mad world we live in, where you have the state so interweaved with everything we do, you will get bigger and bigger problems with state capitalism. You know, there's only one. You know, socialism is appalling and a disaster, but state capitalism, as we know, is bad, and can be really, really bad. The fewer capitalists you have, and the more they capture the state, and that's what we've been having, and that's the trend that I can't see reversing. Actually, sadly, it's going to get worse. Because every time you have these crises, you get more consolidation. You get fewer and fewer players. So the fact that Lloyds is rescuing HBOS, actually it's rescued, they're both being rescued, is a complete disaster. We can have a bank that's got a 30% market share of UK banking that's going to be way too big to fail, way too big to manage, way too big to be a good company. And it's going to be a terrible, terrible thing for the next, I don't know, 8 years. Because you're getting consolidation and fewer players amongst these banks who are basically, not because they're evil themselves, but they're just pursuing their own interests, and their own interests are for collusion and capturing the regulators and doing whatever they bloody well want, which boosts their short-term profits and their bonuses, and that's very good for them, but a disaster for the world. And I can't see any way out of that unless you persuade some politicians and some people, and there is some element of this going on, to create lots of new banks that are properly regulated, that look at not properly regulated, that where consumers can see, and independent ratings agencies can see, a loan to deposit ratio of more than 100% is a bad thing, a capital to assets ratio of more than 10% is a bad thing, sorry, less than 10% is a bad thing, the leverage is a bad thing generally and has to be well justified. But The governments all around the world, and the tax authorities, constantly putting incentives for people to borrow, all the time. All our corporates in the UK have an efficient level of debt, because capital theory says you need an efficient level of debt, basically subsidised by the fact that the interest on the debt is tax-free. So it's tax-deductible. So all corporates have debt because it's tax-deductible. it's just an obvious thing to do. If you're stupid, if you don't have it, basically, and you'll get taken over, actually. The whole of the private equity industry, once upon a time, was supposedly to take doddery old companies and make them better, but actually, over the last 10 years, all it's been about is finding good cash flows that aren't sufficiently geared up and have enough debt, and put the debt in and pay yourself a big bonus with the debt, or dividend with the debt, to walk away. The famous Philip Green, owner of BHS, he did the most terrible 2005-2006. He bought BHS. He was a doddery old company. He didn't have much debt, but he did a few changes and got the cash flows going again. Because it was a big business, had a lot of assets. HBOS lent BHS £1 billion, or £1.2 billion, debt into that company. He owned 100% of that company. He paid himself £1 billion bonus, dividend, out of that company, leaving the company with the debt. HBOS got £100 million, or £200 million bonus, out of it, because they own 20% of BHS. They got their share of it. And you're left with BHS with £1.2 billion in debt for no reason, just because it's got some cash flows. Obviously it's a bit tricky now for everyone, but it doesn't really matter because Philip Green's got his £1 billion and HBOS bankers got some bonuses out of the £200 million they earned, and everything moved on. It's wonderful. And the interest on the debt is tax deductible. So you've got a lot to put right, actually, an awful lot to put right. There are some people who do understand this. Vince Cable is one person, apparently, who I'm told does understand it, because I know some people have talked to him and presented to him on this sort of stuff, and he does think maybe we do need new banks that are soundly run, lots of them.
Well, Tesco's back.
Anyway,
back by RBS, I think. No, they were.
But there are in America tends to run the world, and you know, all the best ideas come out of America. And America tends to run the world, but as far as I can see in America, there's no thought to this, sadly. You'd think some of the libertarians or free marketeers in America would be onto this, but it just seems to be quite a lot of them are moaning about Greenspan and the way his policies
maybe spoken about new banks.
There's very little about new banks. There's very little money about investment banks. Investment banks and hedge funds are the biggest funders of a lot of libertarian activity in America. So I think they're somewhat corrupted by it all. There's a few of them who know what's going on, but none of them have got there. You know, it does seem there's virtually no economist talking about this, as far as I can see. Maybe you know one or two, but there is very, very little going on. And it does, you know, when I was young, I used to be optimistic about the world and think, oh, we can change it. And then they think about these old people thinking, God, you know, they think they're just cynical old bastards, and they think nothing. And I'm telling you, it's a cynical old bastard, which is terrible. I don't want to do that. So I'm going to stop there, because I think you can do something about it, but it's very hard.
Thoroughly miserable now.
What? Only comments, no questions.
What makes you say that big banks would have terrible moves and stuff? You cynical old bastards.
Crazies. Greed. Well, greed, basically. Greed and fear is what drives... greed and fear is what drives human people. Humans. And,
just as bad as we have now?
No, only just as bad, no. Well...
A tenth as bad?
Well, it's deep.
A hundredth as bad?
If you, I mean, in the 19th century and the 20th century, people, banks would go bust and people would lose all their deposits. The deposits would, I've watched various Dickens dramatisations over the years.
Though.
People would, it would make them, make some, people have to be burned before they learn their lessons. There's no way around that. And fear.
Yeah, it's sufficient. Fun? Learning is going a bit
common. Sorry, that's a technical term for the city. Sorry.
You were advocating Dennis being beaten up. No.
Definitely
after a lot of pressure, you could have seen
that
wasn't right.
Thanks, but I think people, you know, if you, I'm watching, you know, dramatizations of Dickens because I can't read the whole Dickens book, but or you watch Mary Poppins. In fact, is Mary Poppins
Run on the Bank?
That has been sent. Yeah, the clip from Mary Poppins about the Run on the Bank, the song, has been sent around, emailed around, you know, obviously been emailed around and put on YouTube, and that it does well illustrate the fear that people had. And in lots of countries in the world, you still, you know, in lots of third world poverty stricken countries where people don't trust the banks, you have runs on banks and you have queues. Hang on. I do remember some queues on the streets around here.
Yeah.
I did take out my assistant actually, and we walked around and looked at the queues. And people queuing outside Northern Rock. Yep. But it should have been allowed
it
to fail.
Really matter,
it would have been better if it had been allowed to fail. But the trouble is. It would have been good, you know. It would have been a good thing if Northern Rock had been allowed to fail. Sure.
The shareholders losing everything. It's the depositors.
You don't mind, yes. But the trouble is with that is that if Northern Rock had failed, you would have. If the depositors had actually lost their money, you would have found the sponsored this queuing very quickly. In fact, they were, you know, there was numerous rumours about Alliance and Leicester and Bradford and Bingley and about Barclays. And if Barclays and Alliance and Leicester and Bradford, it would have been, it was a systemic one. You were and have been and still are, actually, on the brink of a systemic failure. We are still on the brink of a systemic failure. I hear stories of, and you probably know, in fact, people, lots of people buying gold. Buying physical gold is a very difficult thing to do, which is like a run. There are people, I'm told, in probably in this country as well, I don't know, but I'm told in Germany the stories of people just going to get 500 euro notes, as many 500 euro notes out of ATMs as they can. I've been to Germany a couple of times and I haven't seen queues at ATMs. It seems to have been stopped because the Angela Merkel has guaranteed all deposits, so it's kind of okay.
The sales of safes went up in London.
Yeah, no, buying physical gold is quite tricky, quite a difficult thing, especially small denomination gold. It's not that easy. Try and do it yourself. But. And gold and when all commodities, most commodity prices were falling, gold was actually very stable because there was still quite a good demand for gold.
A Ross Barnum would say.
Criticising the poor response that people have coming with solutions and didn't really say anything yourself, that's a bit of quite shocking and terrible. I think what you're saying, what's the problem? And you pointed in here the fact that the institutions are going to persist and the problem will persist, but it's not institutions but ideology that drive political change.
Mm-hmm.
And the situation will only change when there's ideological change. So the only thing we can do is come up with ideas about it there. And you pointed to a lot of the American libertarians, and again pointed out that a lot of them are funded by, I think, the Coke company, Foundation,
yep.
Who are in favour of the Federal Reserve, and therefore, and they fund, I think, Reason and Cato and so forth. But, I don't know if you look at the Mises Institute and their output, but they did push the very hard line. They come across as a bit crankish, and people suspect them of being, you know, tapping a slight anti-Semitic line. I think it's probably the case that anti-Semites quite like their line rather than their line is anti-Semitic, since it was thought of by Jews. The person that's touting at the moment as the economist is Jorge Guido Holzman, who wrote a huge tome called Money, Credit and Banking, I think. And that's a very big chunk, I think, which sort of put the harmony line. But he also wrote quite a nice little, very short little essay called Deflation and Liberty, which ended up in the Institute back to free, where he argues strongly for a massive deflation. A reallocation of the asset prices to the correct use and so forth, and then a plan to move on to end fiat currency altogether, move on to a full commodity currency of gold standard, and fractional reserve banking. I don't know, which is the usual line they push, and then have all investments financed out of savings and not credit or created credit. Now that's a long way off, and there's a lot of argument between whether I think nearly all libertarians, or at least the anarchist ones, have to oppose fiat currencies. The debate between libertarians about whether free banking or an absolute commodity is required. And certainly Kevin McDowell, what's it called, Kevin Dowd?
Kevin Dowd.
Yeah, argued for the free banking solution. But when pressed, I asked him, he did say that, you know, the very fact of free banking would only work in stabilising the banks and making them very conservative and responsible. In an anarchy where you don't have, you know, even if you don't have a central bank, if you've got a government there that's likely to sort of fail out or benefit from things, because one of the things we have to know is that the reason the regulators were lax, I mean, was not, because the government was benefiting from this asset bubble as well. They kept getting re-elected, it makes them look good, they can pose around as financial geniuses, they can take credit for things they haven't done, they can spin a pack of lies about boom and bust. The government is in on it as well, encouraging it, and doing it there, and the banks, it's a combination of the two, and I think the Mises Institute analysis that it's an unholy alliance between bankers and government seems to hold right, and I think it's those there minority voices that will have to prevail, rather than the sort of the slightly more entrenched views of the Cato.
Hayek wrote the denationalisation of money. What was that?
He wrote that.
What was that advocating?
IEA published that.
What was that advocating? What was that?
It was competing currency.
It meant you could go into any national currency. It still meant
nationalised money.
In the short run.
It wasn't the denationalisation of money.
No, it wasn't.
He wanted that, but in the short run, it was better to have. You could pay your taxes in any. You could save in any.
It seems to me that the Victor was following Jorge Portman's solution of massive and rapid deflation, just completely let all the banks just crash and fail as rapidly as possible, which I think is the correct thing to do. Just let them smash into the ground and shatter into pieces. I don't mind all the investors losing their money and all the bankers losing their money. It's the depositors that's to worry. That would cause massive social problem people who've got money in deposit in banks, because they are genuinely the victims of fraud. They've been told of their money. They're just restless.
But if
Keith Robinson machine of derivatives.
I think sadly that if you let a bank crash and burn.
Yeah.
The people who will lose would be the depositors, because investment bankers and the people in the know.
Hence the problem.
People who can. There's an old banking. There's quite a good banker called Peter Burt, who used to run Bank of Scotland, and he's got. I saw him yesterday. Actually, he made an old joke about a banker shouldn't panic. That's the main thing about his first rule of banking is not to panic. But if you do panic, panic first.
Yeah.
And the people in the city are very good at panicking first. Way quicker than the rest of the population. And so I think you'll find that most investment bankers have got their money well spread between a number of different banks, or just in government bonds, actually, or in gold. And you'll find the poorer population will be losing all their savings quite quickly. You'll get an Argentinian situation before you know where you are.
Especially the money.
And there won't be the middle classes will be wiped out, and everyone will dissolve.
That will be disastrous. I agree.
But if you let the banks fail, fully fail, that's where you're going to be very quickly, because one thing you don't quite understand because you've been relying on the reputation of the banks, of Barclays, you see them on the street, Barclays. Halifax, is one thing they've done with their balance sheets that you don't quite see is that as a depositor, it's a fairly brutal word, brutal phrase for you, but you are an unsecured creditor, and you don't know about the number of people who've got precedence over you on the assets of the bank, and there are legions of them, and so they all have first call on the bank's assets before you. And that was one of the most worrying things I thought about when the Northern Rock going on. I knew quite well I was an unsecured creditor, or people who asked me whether they should keep their money in Northern Rock or Barclays. You are so unsecured because they've got such a big balance sheet. Barclays has it changes all the time, but I think it's something like £1.2 trillion of assets. So it has £1.2 trillion of liabilities. It has about £200 billion of deposits, and most of those other creditors, the liabilities of Barclays, the £1 trillion, are ahead of you as a depositor. So you are right at the back of the queue in terms of your ranking on the wind up of the bank, if the bank was actually wound up. It's frightening. It really, really is frightening. And the banks, the mortgages on their balance sheet, what they do is they securitize them. So all the best mortgages are in securitization vehicles, and the people who fund those securitization vehicles have got first call of those mortgages. And that's pretty much that. Then there's things called covered bonds, which are general calls over the rest of the assets. And you don't get any money after that either. So you are really, it's frightening. But you're all going to go and buy gold after finished that. That's the. You're very much at the back of the queue with your money in the bank, if it went bust properly.
Jan and then Bob.
I think my point relates to that to some degree. A lot of people are at the front of the queue.
the Ferrari at the moment about looks like there's going to be bonuses this year. How can you bail them out and give them bonuses? It's just crazy. That's all part of the same system, but they're just not responsible. Especially you.
Well, come again if you're going to be like that.
No.
You have no idea.
As
you have no idea what the world's like. You have no idea the prudential. The covered bonds, which are taking precedence over the depositors, they are bought by prudential and insurance companies and other people, because it gives them better security over the assets. So they actually, we may do our analysis, and we think they're good things to buy, and that means we can pay our annuities, our annuitants, and our life insurance customers, because we've got, you know, because we're buying the securities and we get an income from buying the covered bonds. Okay, we don't really care about the unsecured depositors, that's the bank's issue, but as individuals in society, I think we should, you know, I think it's immoral, these covered bonds that have a general call over the assets of the bank. I think they're appalling, but the bankers themselves think they're wonderful because they get cheap funding, and no wonder they get cheap funding because they're general calls over the assets of the bank ahead of the unsecured depositors who get nothing at the end of the day. They have almost like equity like risk, the unsecured depositors, you and me with our deposits in the banks. So we are utterly naive in a way to put our money in the banks, but I don't know where else you meant to put it. And banks and both societies who are
the private deposits up to the limit are completely guaranteed by the government. That's why they do.
Well, they were.
Sorry,
because the bankers at the top of these banks, there aren't very many banks, and the people who get to the top of these banks are generally politicians who've managed to climb a greasy pole, and they have most of them have no special skills. Quite a lot of them are not very bright. If we had them in here, most of us would run rings around them in terms of the argument. They are really low quality people, in fact, sadly. Often some of them sometimes have got there through, even now some of them got there through marrying the right person. The CEO of Barclays is called John Varley, who was a sort of average solicitor, an upper class solicitor person, who married one of the Pease family, were one of the founding families of Barclays a long time ago, and they've obviously managed to maintain their wealth over the last 200 or 300 years, and there's three sisters, and he married one of the sisters, which is part of the establishment. He was public school in Oxford or something, and went to a top law firm and went to work for Barclays. He married one of the Pease sisters. Another one of the Pease sisters is married, is Nicola Pease, is a fund manager. I can't remember what the third one is. But he married one of these Pease sisters, and it got him, you know, he thought to be a good chap inside Barclays, because he was, you know,
Decent cove,
exactly. And one of the three sisters is Nicola Pease's fund manager. He's married to one, and another one of them is married to someone called Crispin Odie of Odie Asset Management, which is a hedge fund which shorts all financials. So it's totally odious, but he's actually a very nice chap as well. He obviously went to the right school and right college.
Surely nice.
And there is a hedge fund in America that's shorted all this crap, and the guy's given up now and taken his money off to live on the beach or something. And he's attacked the American ruling classes that created this system. And it does sometimes feel like there is a ruling class out there that they're not consciously, you know, it's not like they're evil. It's not a conspiracy. It's what they do. They're just looking after themselves quite happily. And these Peas, there's three Pea sisters, and John Varley happens to be married to one of them. And obviously when they have their Christmases, I suppose, he chats to Crispin Odie, and Crispin Odie says, "Yes, John, that's right, John." But Crispin Odie's quite clever, and he sees John Varley's a complete tosser and thick, and he's got to be the CEO of Barclays through various means. And it just
the
chairman of Barclays is called Marcus Aegeus, who's a Lazard's investment banker, who's one of the ruling classes out there. And they're not class or anything. They're just informal groups of people who look after themselves and their friends, and they're not going out to do evil. They're just incompetent, generally. Well, there's this libertarian who shorted everything. And they just kind of self-perpetuate. And the CEO of Royal Bank of Scotland was Fred Goodwin, Sir Fred Goodwin. John Varley's got to hang on until he gets his knighthood, actually, because he's not Sir John Varley yet, but he's got to wait till the Conservatives get elected, I think, because he's a bit too establishment-minded. But Fred Goodwin was a chippy. Actually, he was the son of a trade union official. A son of a governed shipyard trade union official. He was very clever. Actually, the trade union official, he was quite clever. And he got through school somehow, and got to university and got picked up because he was good at maths by the accountancy firm. He got to be the youngest partner at Deloitte and Touche ever, and they went to work for a bank and got picked out by some other Scottish bloke and got to be made CEO of Royal Bank of Scotland. And he's thick in many ways. I mean, I'm not clever. I don't think I'm very clever. But this guy he's narrow minded. He's narrow minded. He's a bean counter. And for various accidents of history, he got to be CEO of Royal Bank of Scotland. And once he's CEO of Royal Bank of Scotland, he can do what he wants, pretty much, and do all sorts of stupid deals and gear up the bank in all sorts of terrible ways that leads the bank into disaster and kills the bank, because they have their structures and that's the way they work. And there aren't very. And the point is, my point is, there aren't very many of these companies around. And if by accident or hook or by crook the wrong bloke gets to be CEO, they are immensely powerful and have immense patronage. And inside these firms, they get treated like gods. And the bigger the firm, the more godlike they get treated. So he has 100,000 employees or 200,000 employees. You know, and they come and see us at Prudential and they get some chippy bloody bloke like me sort of moaning at them. And they hate it. They really hate it. But they have to come and see us because we're the shareholders. But we, you know, our shareholding is the power of our shareholding is diffused quite a lot because we're institutional shareholders, so I can't do much myself, but I can moan at them and shout at them and give them a hard time. And they hate coming to see us, so they keep coming back. So that's quite fun. But generally, they are, if I was really bad, if I was working in an investment bank where I did before and I was an analyst, I was chippy and annoying, they'd try and get me sacked normally. That's what they do. They'd go to my head of research or the head of the investment bank and say, you're not going to get any business with us if you employ that bloke. That's normally what they do, and so any dissenting voices get crushed normally. And so it's not really in the interest of any of the analysts to be too nasty. Luckily there are lots of investment banks and they're always popping up and they don't have much capital and they get voices and you do get a bit of a market working, and the market does work because eventually, because HBOS and Royal Bank of Scotland and Bank of Barclays, they're so active in the markets. There is knowledge about them, about what they've been doing and the stupid deals they've been doing, and people know, and the share prices collapse eventually. So the truth does get out. But when the truth gets out about a big bank going wrong, you men in the street, us men in the street, are screwed, because you're depositors and you're unsecured depositors, and there's about 60 million people there's so many other interests ahead of you in the queue, really, that are going to get their money first, so the government has to look after you because you're so naive.
So it wasn't so dumb getting a house, because at least the price might go down, but it won't go to nothing. I should say two things. One about I can recommend Arnold Kling. You may know this stuff. He's very good. He actually worked for I think Standard Man or the other one, one of the two, yeah. Anyway, and so he knows where all he speaks, and he's very good on this. I'd like to say a word. I'm not advocating wholesale deflation, if only because they do the wrong thing in consequence. You get an FDR, let's all build windmills because it's good. We need to do it anyway, it employs people, let's do it now. That kind of arse. But still, I should still say that any money is enough if the prices are correct. And everything is still there in the world. The human talent, the inventions, the dockyards, the railways, it's all still there. It's not like a real calamity where there's an asteroid hits us or some bloody thing, or a plague.
That's a war.
That's a truly awful thing. But simply have to readjust your wages or whatever, or take your lick and get on with it. We're all still here. So some people sum up the situation as if we're all done by smoke and mirrors. We're not really as wealthy as we are. Of course you bloody well are.
We're not as wealthy as we thought we were.
Well, yeah, but your consumption is your consumption. You haven't been lied about. You can't lie, you know, bun in your mouth. It's there. This stuff was all made.
There in abundance.
You know, quite so. I mean, you don't have to be a Marxist to believe in the kind of historical materialism. This, all this was actually made. Okay. So, even if all the money crashed,
yeah,
and if you've got money deposits, you've lost. Well, that hasn't even lost, but you're still, well, yeah, you know, healthy strength. And you can still have jobs and turn out exactly the same amount.
What it didn't take out is people's expectations of what's going on. And of course, if you have a massive deflation and a very rapid depression, eventually, we will start going again quite early. But the point is the complete shattering of people's expectations will be so psychologically damaging. It would lead to rioting in the streets and absolutely it would lead to complete social catastrophe, I think, before we got back on the thing. It's difficult one to judge, but if all of a sudden people are looking forward to a sort of country retirement, they're thrown back, honestly.
Mind you, all of these are no more fake than the state promises of Medicaid or pensions. That's as Ponzi as scheme as.
I'm sympathetic to the view, but it's just, the shuffling of expectations would be catastrophic,
It's funny about Jan talking about class analysis. It is, I do sound like a socialist. It's terrible. I do sound like I've got class analysis. Because it does appear as though there is a class out there.
I do a libertarian class analysis. Yeah. Steve Davis does it from Manchester.
It does feel like there's a ruling class out there, but there aren't, because Fred Gilbin, the guy who got to the top of the Royal Bank of Scotland, he was son of a trade union official. He got to the top, and John Varley got to the top, and they equally fought over something called ABN AMRO, this Dutch bank, in a really stupid fight for something that wasn't worth buying, and they destroyed Barclays, who's going to be destroyed as well, and there's the bloke called Andy Hornby, who got to the top of HBOS, Halifax Bank of Scotland. I don't think he's particularly part of this ruling class, John Varley fits the thing of being part of the ruling class so much. Or maybe, because he married into it, maybe, but if it existed. But Andy Hornby, he worked really hard, and he was, he was equally useless. But contrasting him to Fred Goodwin, Andy Hornby did all the right things. You know, middle class background, whatever, I don't know. But he went to university, he went to Harvard, and he was first in the class at Harvard Business School.
Cool.
Top of the class at Harvard Business School. And then went to Astor and was a sort of fantastic retail entrepreneur and did something there. And then got promoted to head of retail banking at HBOS, and then got the job, top job at HBOS. But he had no clue about return on capital when he got to the top of HBOS. And he just ploughed on regardless, piling high, selling it cheap, because that was the Asda model. And he wasn't a banker, he wasn't the right person, but he got to the top. So he got three useless bankers at the top of three of the biggest UK banks. What a recipe for disaster. But that happens the world over.
That's what happens.
Oh, we did.
No, one was higher order, one was middle order, one was lower order.
Sorry. I just wanted to ask you said that inevitable for the people.
Yes.
There was this feeling in the late 90s, early, but this whole thing about soft landings and all that, and that somehow or other by adjusting
boom and
moving, you could avoid these. And I can see that you could argue that it's inevitable that a mistake will be made sooner or later. But I don't actually see why, apart from that, why it's inevitable that you can't regulate.
Because the regulators are stupid. And
When I say regulate, I mean regulating.
Self-regulation. Market regulation.
What I mean is that when you put the money into the market at the time when things are slowing down, then it sort of you stop the recession developing.
Yeah, well, because people, because, you know, I don't know about you, but I often get enthusiasms for things. They turn out to be completely pointless and useless and damaging and loss making, and I can't help myself because I think I've got some idea of what's going on, and I've always been sceptical of the bankers that run these banks, having met them close up, and got very sceptical. But obviously, I get, and people think I've been too aggressive with them. My colleagues think I've been too aggressive, and most of the time, I think I'm too aggressive, and I shouldn't go to the meetings, or if I'm going to go to the meetings, I've got to keep quiet or stay calm and not get angry with them and all that sort of thing. But I can't help myself. But I can just see it. My colleagues, the fund managers at Prudential, they get enthusiastic about things. Some of them don't, and some of them, you know, and that's good. And they hold out, and if they hold out long enough, I think it's what Keynes said actually, is that the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. And it's one of those things. If enough people are doing something stupid, it can go on for quite a long time until a lot of them. And if you're one of the people who's saying it's a stupid idea, you'll go bust while they're still being irrational. Well, it's a madness. And is it the madness in the theory of crowds? Tulip mania. I don't think there's any governments involved in tulip mania.
You can get mania.
You can just get mania. You can just get passions. I've got, you know, just get passions for the same thing. Fashion is like that. You know, fashions come and go, but they can't abolish fashions. And investment fashions are no different to fashions, clothing fashions. I think it's interesting on that, because Mr. Chairman, if I don't just talk about Japan for a second, is Japan the Japanese economic miracle? A bit like many economic miracles. There's some economic miracles when you have free markets come in, when you go from socialism to capitalism. That is like a miracle, because finally you're getting some rational allocation of resources. But very often you get miracles when you get large movements of population from low productivity jobs in agriculture to higher productivity jobs in cities. And when you've had some artificial obstacles to that for various reasons, and you suddenly get a big move to cities, you can get a massive increase in productivity. And that can look like it is kind of a miracle, because people are working in more productive ways than they were digging holes and putting a seed in and waiting 6 months for the thing to sprout and then harvesting it 3 months later. That's partly like a Chinese one, but the Japanese one was a bit like that in the 1960s. It was basically a big movement of population from farms to cities, and that did produce a huge increase in productivity. And that was a Japanese miracle. It wasn't necessarily free markets. It was just they'd had some problems, you know, they'd been rather bombastic. They'd had medieval, you know, in 1866, Japan emerged from feudalism, massive state control of where people were. And they had a boom, and then they got ahead of themselves and ended up getting smashed to smithereens in the Second World War. And then it took 10, 20 years to recover from that. And then there was the boom as they kind of recovered from that. But then it's over, and the population movements, the demographic changes that actually caused the miracle, are over, and that's that. And there are a load of old people. You know, they've got massive dependency ratios in Japan, and it's finished. The Chinese miracle is going to come to an end quite soon, because people are going to finish moving from the farms. They've had their one-child policy, and the population, the young people in the population, is going to shrink relative to the number of older people, and that will be that. That will be over. So I think there are demographic things that sometimes hide real, you know, the sort of general economic growth of 2% a year, which most people get and most people should expect. You can get 6 or 7 or 8% when you're getting some big demographic changes, but it's just a flash in the pan. It won't last.
Paul, Bob, then Andrew.
Yeah, I'm not going to this about whether allowing a huge deflation to happen would be a good idea or not. It seems that but it depends on how things turn out. If it just turns out that we're back to our living standards 5 years ago, then that's sort of a quite money managed thing. But it seems to me that the government intent on massively reflating the economy, and are probably following a course of policies. I mean, Obama doesn't look as if he's got any right ideas at all, and they could really be pushing it into a complete catastrophe where, you know, we end up sort of strapping them out to berries and
back to the
eating children, you know, so yeah, that sort of thing, you know, sort of thing. And And then the massive deflation will happen anyway. Whether it becomes now, but if there is a massive deflation, it's good afterwards. But yeah, I think then libertarian view would need to stand ready. to start naming the guilty, punishing them in large arenas, and expropriating their assets to compensate.
But certainly there is no... His banks are so geared, and his chief executives are so small in their wealth compared to the amount of damage they've done,
but
there's nothing you can do.
No, I know,
There's nothing you can do.
Share out whatever gold is left in proportion to people that have money on deposit, and start again. But yeah, if the political situation, I suspect it probably some sort of muddle through will happen. But I might be wrong. It might be a complete capitalism.
We're not going to get deflation because the governments are. The U.S. government is committed to massively.
You might cause a hyperinflation. You might not have America in the '30s. You might have Germany in the '30s instead.
Zimbabwe.
I think you might have Nazis for that. I don't know. Mm. I don't know. Who knows? Very difficult. The numbers on the deflation, the numbers are mind-boggling in terms of when I said about 350% of US GDP, we're talking about some of the derivatives out there, the credit default swap derivatives, there's $50 trillion of credit default swap derivatives. That's right, no risk there, we know that. Yes, of course they are, absolutely. As long as you're netted out with the right person who's not gone bust, that's all right. As long as there's no counterparty risk, you're right. They're not netted out. They claim they're netted out, but it's not exactly clear they're netted out.
What?
But the point is, the US government has got... I don't have enough time to read the papers, because I'm kind of ahead of the curve, because I've got my BlackBerry and I can get information, but the point is, there's the number of US government programs out there pumping money into the economy. The $700 billion thing we talked about that we had to have, but otherwise the world would come to an end. They spent $350 billion.
Something else, not the thing they had to
spend. And they're going to spend the other $350. But they've got $1.8 trillion ready to invest in commercial paper, what I was talking about earlier on. And they've already spent $350 billion of that. There's a Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation that has decided to guarantee all the near-term liabilities of all US banks. And that, I think there's several hundred billion dollars already spent on that. And if you're not a bank, you're converting to a bank. So American Express, that was only a credit financial company, is now converted to a bank. And other people want to convert to banks quite quickly because it's quite a good thing.
That's where the money is going.
And so there are quite a lot of... There is hundreds of billions of dollars guaranteed debt already by the government, the US government. And the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve has more than doubled in the last few months, as they've been pouring this money out to try and stop the bubble deflating, stop the balloon shrinking. And so there is, it goes back to your point, there is a kind of battle out there between the amount of money that the government's chucking in with the amount of money that the banks are having, or not the banks so much themselves, but the various vehicles that are created that are shrinking, they can't do it, they're losing all their money. People just putting money with the banks, but it's got so the situation is so ridiculous that the banks that are being told to lend and stop the bubble deflating, they're a bit worried about the way this world's going as well themselves, so parts of them. And so what they're doing is they're giving the money to the central banks
It pays more,
but in Europe and the UK they're doing the same thing. It doesn't pay so much more there, but they're lending money. They don't trust each other. They just need their short-term liquidity. Because they're not sure what's coming round the corner. So there's like $700 billion with the three big central banks overnight put there by the banks. Because actually it's not just the banks. The customers of the banks are saying, we're giving you our money, but we want you to give it to the central bank. Don't lend it to anyone, please, overnight. So you kind of got, so the banks are deflating because that's what the world wants, and the government's in other parts of the thing saying, no, please stop, you must lend, and we're going to lend you whatever you want to whoever, anyone who wants money can come and get it pretty much, and that's going on as well at the same time. And the governments obviously then have to neutralise that, otherwise they get inflation, because as they lend money out to people, unless they can then borrow it themselves through bond issuance, then you will get inflation, which is product inflation, because we've had, that's what I do struggle with sometimes. We get the CPI, consumer price inflation, but if you don't have an asset inflation measure, assets and product and consumer prices, you would have had inflation for the last several years, because you've had massive asset price inflation. And then you get the asset price deflation, which maybe swamps the I'm going to fucking rubbish that, but the consumer product is a kind of such a small bit of the world economy. But the assets are a big part of the world economy, and the consumer product is a tiny part.
Is
because
the
it's a good question. They put the cost of the mortgage into the consumer, some measures of consumer price inflation, don't they? But they don't put the house into it. But if you look, when you've got 350% debt to GDP, the gross domestic product, the products are inflating at 2 or 3%, but the stuff that the credit's buying is inflating at 20 or 30%. So you're going up 20 or 30%. And it's a I think it's quite conceptual. I find it hard to square that circle between consumer prices and asset prices.
Well, it's a kind of good old Hayekian argument that perhaps you can't know what's going on there, but it's supposed to have a set of institutions that are much easier to understand, but you don't even have to understand them, which is why if you had a free banking system with worldwide branches, you wouldn't in effect have national currencies at all. So at a stroke you have all the massive sudden changes in exchange rate, that wouldn't be part of the question anymore. So that would go, these banks would lend to each other from around the world, so it will be so much better. Now you might still get fashions for this or years for that, but it wouldn't have anything like the dislocating effect of that thing. Now we can't get that, but the important thing for libertarians is that at least they can have a narrative, what caused it, what will be better. Now everyone else might be going green or Keynesian, or what can you do? You can't, you've got to say what you think, and it's there, and if you don't win, at least you said the right said the right thing. He was right 300 years later or so. Well, that's a kind of honour in something,
because the rate of inflation for you is the rate of inflation for some people is the rate of increase in the price of beer. But the rate of inflation for a baby boomer in America with $100,000 in his money market account is something different, isn't it? Because he's not really buying much beer. He's just concerned about personal fitness and living till he's 160. And so he's I don't know what he's thinking is his rate of inflation is. He's probably asset price inflation is probably something.
Of the broad money supply, as you say, we have this huge inflation of money supply by the leveraging up of the financial sector, gearing the financial sector, if you speak English. I've worked for too many American investment banks, I speak American. So we have this huge increase in the money supply, but we didn't call it inflation because the inflation was all happening in asset values, not consumer price values. But in terms of, Milton Friedman, inflation is everywhere and always a monetary phenomenon. Monetarily, we had massive inflation. It just didn't show up in high street prices.
CPI.
And now we have the de-gearing of the financial system. We've got the central bank trying to inflate just to compensate from that de-gearing, we're still getting deflation currently. We are in deflation in that the money supply is shrinking. Again, asset prices are falling. Consumer prices may well rise during this deflation. As you said, on average...
It's only asset price deflation.
So prices are falling. Consumer prices are rising, asset prices are falling. I think you're right about these, about the inevitability of these cycles, but obviously what we have here is a exceptionally severe one.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think you're entirely right that the Basel II is a large part of it.
Mark-to-market, yeah.
Well, mark-to-market, your risk is what you've estimated your risk to be. I have papers in here which I'm not going to talk about on the record. Your model can be very good, but if they're wrong in one little place, you'll end up owning an awful lot of the things that is wrong in one little place. It's not that the models were dreadful, it's that they were as good as they could expect to be, and they only need to be. You're catching stuff in a plastic bag with one hole in it, and the water is flowing out the hole, and the hole were these mortgage-backed securities. And the bubble, I am required not to talk about financial markets.
All right,
about markets.
You left the record.
Off the record here. The day that Bear Stearns went bust.
Yeah. Rescued by J.P. Morgan.
The day it needed to be rescued, March 14th, March 15th, I was working there as a programmer. I was working for the risk management group. I was working on a project that I'd been working on for several months, designed to show the regulator that we had much more capital than we needed and should be allowed to leverage that more. And I can show you something.
You already thought this, or you were required to show it?
I didn't know. I was working on equity. It was equity derivative. How do we model our equity derivative?
Yeah.
What is our systematic risk? What is our specific risk on equity derivative? And that's what I was working on.
There's so many Tony accountants you meet, who said they would worked in the they did a bit of auditing of a financial services firm, and they would go a bit of ticking and some little bit of the product. None of them ever understand the little bit they're working on, and then they think this financial services is not for me, I haven't got a clue what's going on. Or they think it doesn't matter, no one seems to care, I think it's a great life, I'm going to go off and do it. There's Michael Lewis, who wrote Liar's Poker, famously.
Yeah.
And there's an article he wrote just a few days ago, actually, that was very interesting. You've probably got it there. You've got two of it. It's a very, very good article. It's a marvellous article, it's funny, he wrote his book, he said one of the funniest things in there, he says he wrote his book. There's two things in there, actually. One is kind of funny. He wrote his book, Liar's Poker, hoping to put people off going into the industry. But it became a manual for people to go into the industry.
I was a student at the time. I knew it was 10 years later that I actually entered the industry. I did.
I've just had a hardly graduate training.
I had colleagues at university who were reading it as instruction.
I thought, hey, this is a quick way to $100,000 a year and massive bonuses. So I thought, if it's that. But I've just had a graduate training who kind of read it, knew all about it, and he still comes to work for us. But Michael Lewis says he wrote the book hoping people would give up on it and go off and, become musicians or oceanographers or something, and he's hoping that this time round it might really happen, but I can't see it. The other interesting thing in there he says is that he tries to argue that if investment banks or banks had stayed partnerships and hadn't got equity shareholders, then that might have been a better way around, better way for the thing to work. And but actually that's complete crap, because Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns were very heavily, and Goldman Sachs, very heavily employee owned. And they were just as bad as anyone else.
The people in charge lost hundreds of millions. This was not the normal Wall Street scandal. The normal Wall Street scandal is that the bankers rip off the populace. This time they really believed it, and they lost their own money along with everything else.
It's fantastic. It's fantastic.
There's a point tied up with Arnold Klinger. I mentioned he makes the distinction between the suits and the geeks.
Mm.
It's a bit like your point that the ones at the top, they're the suits.
Mm.
And even if the geeks tell them it's it could, you know, there's a, yeah. there's a slight risk, the slight risk of something very, very bad happening, and they didn't get it.
It's too difficult to understand. I've worked several days on somebody to go out and do some of the more exotic instruments that these people have created, and I find it really, really hard to understand them. And they seem so, with hindsight, they seem so mad, really, really mad.
Doesn't it all depend on a rising market?
You know, the investor was never really told what the key risk was. Quite often, is never told what the key risk is because. Why tell them? You know, like an unsecured depositor, like us guys with our money in the banks, we're not really told that almost all of the assets of the bank are spoken for, and we're just there at the end. You're not really told that, are you? I'm not. Banks wouldn't tell you that, would you? And the regulators don't tell you that, and the government doesn't tell you that.
Not the word deposit, it's a fraudulent
loan. Unless you have a warehouse in the Rothbardi Manor.
Well, they are
going to lend it out.
Okay, fractional reserve banking.
And they didn't know it
was. It's evil, and therefore we should outlaw all fractional reserve banking.
Yeah, but you did know they were lending it out. You do know that they lend your money out.
It's very evil.
You know.
It's very evil.
I think the average bloke in the street doesn't.
No, I don't think he does.
When my kids got their nationwide ISA, you know, nationwide, whatever, children's. ISIS or whatever they've got. They put their money. I don't think my kids realise the money was being. They have no concept of that. Then you have to explain to them how to get their interest, why they're getting 5% a year on it or whatever. And then they look suspicious. Lending it to people. So we get our 5% from. I think they'd rather not have 5% than the idea of lending it to people. If that's what they thought, I'm not sure they. And if they really thought that there was danger that they'd lose 10% of their money because the loans go bad. Then they wouldn't do it. I don't think they'd do it, you know, if people understood.
Yeah, no,
I don't think people would do it.
Jeremy, and then Paul. Yes. I just want to say about our clinger, if you want to hear what he says, he's on econtalk.org.
Yeah, I've heard that one.
A couple of times recently.
Leon.
Ross Roberts.
It's Liberty Fund, isn't it?
Yeah.
George Mason.
Well, just look for their names. They're worth it. They're usually coming down the telephone, sadly. Mm-hmm. They're not in the studio, so one sounds good, the other sounds shut. Mm-hmm. The content's very good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't entirely go along with the Walter Block's view that fractional reserve banking is now out and out, always impermissible, entirely fraudulent system. But it certainly is the way it's conducted at the moment. The only way it would be compatible with libertarianism is if it's not called, you know, putting your money on deposit, it's safe houses, banking with us, you know, with them.
Somewhat risky.
If it's sold as highly liquid investment, you know, something like that, you know, it's the fact that people are tricked. That's what's under libertarian about. It's the fact that there's systematic trickery going on. And insofar as any banking system is fine, insofar as people are being lied to and defrauded.
If you ban fractional reserve banking, how can you pay interest on deposits?
You can't ban
fractional reserve banking because you can't ban money lending.
You can't ban
something. It's like trying to ban prostitution. You can't ban it because there will be people doing it.
You could
say
you can't ban murder
because
there will be people doing it.
But it's not hurting anyone, is it? If I tell you I'm going to lend out 90% of the month deposits I get in.
But if I tell you that,
that's okay, isn't it?
It should be okay.
And I suspect they are.
Well,
I don't think people are fooled of them, but it's not really easy.
They're
ignorant.
Precisely so. But more to the point, it's not just the trickery there as well. If you get rid of the fear, if you get rid of the thing about fractional reserve banking at the moment, it's all guaranteed by government, or nominally anyway.
Yeah.
So the whole thing at the moment is if you take the full anarcho-libertarian, if we're assuming how fractional reserve banking might operate in an anarcho-libertarian world where you haven't got fiat currency and you haven't got government
running business. How might this be the case?
Depositors would have to be a lot more cautious.
I'm going to probably have to call something other than deposit, because deposit in that thing would mean just simply storing it in a warehouse. That's depositing, you know, for convenience sake. That's what a deposit should be. The rest of it has to be legitimate investment. But the thing is, that wouldn't be fractional reserve banking. Because fractional reserve banking in a fully libertarian society still seems to me to be fraudulent, because you've got there two different, as Block points out, two different people laying claim, laying equal legal title to the same asset. And that cannot be right. You cannot, because then when people say, I'm worth this, somebody else that declares that I'm worth that for, you know, collateral purposes or whatever, they're not actually worth that. They're worth, you know, if you haven't factored in the risk, that it's not really just an asset, it's in fact it's an illiquid investment. So it seems to me that fractional reserve banking, as it's normally seen and defended, could not exist in a fully libertarian society. It would have to be called something else. It would have to be a form of investment.
It would be called something else.
If you're one of Michael Lewis's acolytes, you want to run in class, it's much easier. Yeah. Which is what Engels did, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, he was already in it, wasn't he?
He was already in it,
yeah, from his father. Marx was given a settlement. Oh,
yeah. Marx was born into the running class by Engels. He was given the house and so on.
It's a situational cohesion.
We'll come back in another 25 years, James.
Yes.
And give us the
part
two.
No.
No, it's just out of work, that is.
Oh. Should be happily retired by then, didn't
you? Happily. Well, depends where all the money is.
Investments?
I don't know. I think he's going back to buying a plot of land and farming it.
Well, the sad thing is, it makes a mug out of saving, doesn't it? I mean, the obvious thing to be now is to be not in debt, have no savings, whatever, and house you're letting out.
It was about 4 weeks ago, this German banker came over and talked to us, and he was so depressed. He was the one who was talking about his bloody ATMs and the €500 notes and the gold coming out of his pocket. It was so depressing. He really got a feel that they're in for the wheelbarrows, you know, the old wheelbarrows to buy a cup of coffee thing. He's the head of a small German bank. He's not up for that.
One story was that they're bringing wheelbarrows out of with German notes. People just go.
The wheelbarrows are worth more than the notes.
They were actually taking out new
wheelbarrows.
Incidentally, only about 5 months ago, the high inflation was over before they came into power.
But the grudge was there, the result of it, the peak of middle class. They got the whole world run to pieces, so, can't be about the old thing. I've
been reading Sebastian Hafner's accounts and
anyway, what's to be done? What is to be done? What was that book?
I'm actually going to Shakespeare's Head, actually. It's almost going to take a kind of religious revival. Almost
of what?
Thick-headed, keen people saying, honest money, genuine money.
Anomaly, that's it.
Not really understand the theory.
Just have a look at it. It's like a mobile email.
And telephone.
What it is? I've got. Hang on. Well, I've got telephones, like, you know, call like telephones, people I've run recently. I've got your email. These are all my emails. You get text messages. These are text messages, mostly from Helen, a little bit from my son. That sort of thing, you know, it's good sometimes. And then you've got a calendar, so it's like a diary. I'll put the name of the pub in here.
Oh, yeah, he must have had a lot of people talking to him.
He's talking about computer stuff. I've heard it before at the IA some years ago. And send emails, but no one's got them.
Did you go to the LAE? The other LAE thing?
Yes,
did
you?
What was your view of it?
Is it still on, Bob?
It would have been, after 6 hours it will stop. God, we're only on a better one. I think you just press stop.
That would do it.
Right.